their side. "We'll meet again." Belinda Lynn felt a lump in his throat as he watched his friend stride majestically through the gates and across the bridge, shielded by the secondlings' arrows and catapults, until he and his warriors were close enough to engage their orcish foes. Belinda Lynn didn't have long to wait, until a cry went up among the horrified warriors that Gundrabur had fallen. It was then that he decided to ignore the late king's advice and see to it that Bislapur died. "Dwarves are no friends of water," he thought grimly. "Fire is our element." On the fifth orbit after the High King's passing, the taverns, quarries, and workshops of the Secondling Kingdom were still closed. Thousands of dwarves from the 17 clans of Berowyn's folk had gathered in the funeral hall, whose vast pillars towered so high and dwindled into the distance. The focal point was a stone sarcophagus, hewn by the Secondling's finest masons, and decorated with wondrous carvings commemorating Gundrabur's glorious deeds, not least his last battle at the High Pass where the orcs had been routed. Carved into the lid of the coffin was a perfect likeness of the monarch in his younger years. The marble Gundrabur was dressed in his finest armor, his right hand clasping the haft of his axe. Even those at the back of the hall could see the sculpted body resting on the dais, high above the heads of the crowd. Slender rays of sunshine slanted through chinks in the ceiling, converging on the coffin from all points of the compass and bathing the effigy in iridescent light. "The moment of parting has come." Belinda Lynn ascended the steps and stopped at the High King's feet. Kneeling down, he lowered his head and paid his respects to the fallen monarch. Then he got up and surveyed the secondlings for a final time before he was appointed king. "Gundrabur sensed the invaders before they were spotted from the watchtowers. He was always the first to detect our enemies and preserve us from harm." As he spoke, he found himself looking at Bislapur, who was standing with the Fourthling delegates at the edge of the crowd. Not even Gandogar's scheming advisor could excuse himself from an occasion such as this. "Our king was called to Vrakas before he could realize his dream of a united dwarven assembly. But he took the first step toward creating a new and stronger union of the folks. From this moment on, his goals will be mine, and I swear in the name of Vrakas to complete his work before I die." Banging the hafts of their axes against the floor, the secondlings signaled their approval. A low roll of thunder rumbled through the mountain. Belinda Lynn was too choked with emotion to say anything further, so he walked to the head of the coffin, kissed the brow of the marble king, bowed again, and left the dais. With that, 50 dwarves hurried over and hooked long poles into the metal rings, subtly incorporated into the coffin's design. As soon as the order was given, they lifted the coffin, carried it from the dais, and bore it silently past the rows of dwarves, who bowed a final time as their dead monarch was taken to his resting place in the Crypt of Kings. Belinda Lynn walked behind the coffin. He would watch over Gundrabur's body during the long hours of the night, ending his vigil in the morning, when he would leave the crypt with the secondling crown. In time, he too would be laid to rest with the rulers of his folk. From the corner of his eye, he spotted Bislapur pushing his way to the front of the crowd. The Fourthling's gaze was fixed on him, as if to read his thoughts and divine the nature of the vengeance that Belinda Lynn had in mind. "You are right to fear me, Bislapur. Your crimes won't go unpunished." Looking straight ahead, Belinda Lynn didn't let on that he had seen the brawny dwarf. At length, the pallbearers entered the Crypt of Kings and placed the coffin on its basalt stand. High above, an opening had been cut out of the mountain, allowing the light of Gerdlegard to shine on Gundrabur's marble face. The attendants filed out of the vast crypt that housed the mortal remains of the Secondling Kings, 26 in all. Belinda Lynn walked to the far end of the vault, placed the haft of his axe on the floor, and leaned on the axe head. His gaze fell on the sculpted countenance of his friend and sovereign. "Fare you well, Gundrabur." As the moments passed, he too became stone, insensible to the passing of time. His eyes stared blankly at the coffin, while his mind relinquished all thought and drifted on a sea of sorrow. At times it seemed to him that voices were speaking to him in ghostly whispers, but he understood nothing of what they said. According to Secondling legend, Vlachos would open the eternal smithy and release the spirits of the dead kings, who would visit the prospective monarch and pass judgment on his worth. In some cases, the heir to the throne entered the vault and was never seen again. Belendilin was spared such a fate. The next morning, tired, aching and bleary-eyed, he left the crypt to find the waiting dwarves exactly where he had left them many hours before. The secondlings bowed and drummed their axes against the floor, hailing their new king and offering him beer, bread and ham to restore his strength. Belendilin took a few mouthfuls, washed them down and ascended the dais where Gundrabur's coffin had lain.
"I did not seek this office," he said in a loud, clear voice. "It was my hope that Gundrabur would reign for another 100 cycles, so I could serve him loyally. But Vlachos decided otherwise. 14 orcs died by Gundrabur's axe, and 4 arrows pierced his flesh before our king was gathered to the eternal smithy."
His gaze swept the hall.
"He named me as his successor, and so I ask you, will you have me as your king?"
The crowd chorused a resounding aye. Wooden hafts pounded the stone, and Belendilin realized with a rush of emotion that the secondlings were chanting his name.
"Beroene's folk has chosen. Let us never forget Gundrabur or his dream of uniting our kin. It is our shared duty, irrespective of clan or folk, to defend Gerdlegard against all harm."
His eyes sought Bislapur and found him where he had been standing before.
"Join me,"
he said, extending his hand. The startled Bislapur limped up the steps to the dais and greeted the new monarch with a nod. His cold brown eyes stared at him uncertainly.
"The death of Gundrabur has robbed our folks of their high king. The succession will not be decided until the 5th and final challenge is complete. As I'm sure you know, Bislapur and I have not seen eye to eye, but I cannot allow a rift to open between our folks. Friendship must not be turned to enmity, which is why I solemnly swear to put aside our differences until one or the other of the candidates has returned."
He drew himself up to his full height.
"When dwarf fights dwarf, only our enemies stand to gain. The new High King will set our course, and we will obey his orders and submit to his will."
Belendilin held out his hand to Bislapur.
"Let us shake on it."
His antagonist had no choice but to comply. To Belendilin's astonishment, he seemed neither angry nor resentful.
"I swear that neither of us will promote our separate causes until the new High King has returned," he promised, choosing his words with care. "We may disagree on certain matters, but we share a common enemy, evil in all its forms. As dwarves, we are committed to wiping out evil wherever it occurs, and we shall not tire in our duty."
A loud cheer went up as the pair shook hands and looked each other in the eye. No one could tell that their gazes were locked in an oath of eternal enmity.
"As a sign of my good faith, I should like to suggest that we begin our crusade against evil this very moment," announced Bislapur. "Will we stand by while orcs murder and pillage before the gates of this stronghold?"
He turned to the crowd and raised his voice to a rallying shout.
"We must clear Augur's death of this plague!"
On hearing the cheers, he knew he had judged the mood right.
"My messenger is heading through the tunnels to the Fourthling Kingdom as I speak. He will return with 5,000 of our finest warriors,"
he proclaimed to the astonished Belendilin and the crowd.
"Together, the dwarves of Beroene and Goimdil will chase the orcs from these gates. United, our folks will prevail."
He threw up his arms and brandished his double-bladed axe, dazzling the dwarves with reflected light.
"This is our chance to realize Gundrabur's dream of a common dwarven army."
The cheering redoubled, and the mountain shook with the drumming of axes. Belendilin bore the treachery smilingly and gazed intently into Bislapur's hard face.
"You don't fool me, you devious bastard. Are the warriors meant for your protection, or are you after the High King's throne? Would you stage a coup so you can have your elven war?"
Bislapur stared back, his cold eyes boring into him mercilessly.
"May the hunt begin, King Belendilin," he said, descending from the dais.
Belendilin was left to wonder who the quarry might be.
Chapter 2. Enchanted Realm of Oromyra, Gerdlegard, Late Autumn, 6234th Solar Cycle. The following morning, after a cold night that heralded the coming of winter, they loaded the ingots onto the ponies and headed west. The smoke had cleared above the deserted streets of Mifodania, and tiny black dots lay unmoving at the foot of the settlement's walls. Every dot was a corpse, and they covered the area in a sea of black. Tungdil hated Nodon and the orcs more violently than ever.
"First Goodwater, then Greenglade, and now Mifodania, and all the other villages, hamlets and farms. Half of Gerdlegard has been razed to the ground."
He spotted a cloud of dust on the horizon. The army of orcs was heading northwest.
"I'll do whatever it takes," he promised himself.
Much to the dwarves' disgust, their provisions for the journey consisted almost entirely of bread and dried fruit, which they were forced to eat for want of anything else. In their haste to leave Mifodania, they had forgotten to stock up on victuals, and no one was inclined to venture back. They were all the more grateful when Goimgar found a few wild mushrooms, even though they had to eat them raw.
"Do you really mean to take them with us?"
asked Boindil, casting a quick look over his shoulder at Rodario and his companions, who were bringing up the rear.
"We'll decide when we get to the tunnel," said Tungdil. "It's 80 miles to the next entrance, and if we can't find it, we'll continue on foot."
"On foot? Can't you buy us each a pony?"
demanded Goimgar. Boindil harrumphed.
"A bit of exercise might be just the thing for your puny little legs. It's time you pulled yourself together and started acting like a dwarf. Even the female Longan is tougher than you."
After two orbits of marching in the pouring rain, they reached a low-lying area bounded to the north by imposing mountains, the Sovereign Stones, as they were labelled on the map. Nestled in the foothills was the human settlement of Sovereignston, which Tungdil remembered was famous for its wealth. It was the fashionable place for Wayan's gentry to build their palatial villas and stately homes. The attraction was not so much the mountain air, but the prestige to be gained by living there, and of course, the social whirl.
"We'll stay only long enough to buy some ponies," Tungdil told his companions on approaching the gates. "It'll be cheaper and safer to look for provisions and ponies in the poorer parts of town. We'll leave the rich folk and their villas well alone."
"What a terrible pity,"
said Rodario in an exaggeratedly aristocratic voice.
"It seems churlish not to visit our wealthy neighbours after living on their doorstep all this time."
He was relieved to see that the solid city walls were lined with armed guards. The orcs would never be able to get hold of them once they passed through the gates. He turned to his companions excitedly.
"Why don't we put on a play? Nothing long or complicated, just a short impromptu performance. We'd earn enough bronze coins to fill our bags with victuals, and keep the proverbial wolf from the door."
"Can't you speak normally for a change?"
growled Boindil, scratching his stubbly cheeks, which were long overdue for a shave.
"I shall speak in whichever way I choose, Master Dwarf," the actor said huffily. "Some people are blessed with communicative talents beyond the level of primitive grunts, burps, and growls. I don't see why I should disguise the magnificence of my education when you do nothing to hide the paucity of yours."
"Fine," Boindil muttered malevolently. "We'll see how far your fine words get you when we meet a pack of orcs."
His brother changed the subject by asking how the impresario had breathed fire at the Bognilim. Rodario beamed.
"You can thank Fergus for that. The trick is to fill a tube with lycopodium spores, put on the dragon mask, and blow through the tube. The spores pass over a burning wick at the mouth of the mask, and the monster spews fire."
He rolled up his sleeves.
I use a smaller version when I'm playing the Magus. The tube runs down my forearm, connecting a leather purse of spores at my elbow, with a miniature tinderbox just inside my cuff.
He held up his arm and gestured expansively to demonstrate the technique.
I squeeze the purse like so, and the seeds shoot down the tube. And meanwhile, the pressure on the pouch activates a cord that pulls the flint backward and produces a spark. Presto! The seeds are ignited as they exit my sleeve.
His hands mimicked the flight of a fireball.
So there you have it, a magic trick for magic flames.
Bowendal, who had been following the explanation carefully, shot Fergus an admiring look.
An ingenious invention.
The prop master accepted the compliment with a nod. They joined the back of a queue of wagons and carriages owned by Mifodanians and merchants who had fled the unfortunate city. Sentries were checking the vehicles, noting exactly what they were carrying, and demanding a toll. No distinction was made between farmers, traders, and other travellers, so the city of Sovereignstone made a considerable profit from the dwarves. Not only that, but as visitors to the Kingdom of Weyen, Tungdil and the others were restricted to the poorest districts of the city, and given the address of a boarding house in which they were required to stay. Thus constrained, they trudged up a narrow street, and turned into a passageway that was barely wide enough for single file. Both sides of the alley were crammed with timber houses, whose upper stories jutted out dangerously, almost meeting overhead. The uneven cobblestones never saw daylight. All in all, it wasn't dissimilar to an underground gallery, except for the stench of sewage and detritus. Mounted on one of the bulging walls was a sign showing a prancing pony. They had found their address. With a shudder of disgust, Rodario searched the pockets of his rain-drenched coat, pulled out a handkerchief, and pressed it to his mouth and nose.
"With all due respect," he said firmly, "nothing could induce me to sleep in such a hovel."
It was evident from their expressions that Fergus and Narmora felt the same.
"Fortunately, I have a solution to our dilemma. My companions and I will spend the night in more salubrious accommodations, and will meet you tomorrow morning at the gates. You'll have time to buy your ponies and so forth, and we'll find a venue and put on a play. How does that sound?"
The suggestion was greeted enthusiastically by Bowindil, who was tired of the actor's voice. Rodario didn't wait for further permission, but strode away at once, his vibrant robes flapping around his legs. There was no denying that he looked like a nobleman, but the duffel bag rather ruined the effect. Fergus and Narmora followed him down the alleyway, boots squelching as they trudged through the foul-smelling mud.
"To be honest with you, I think they've got a point,"
ventured Goimgar, peering after them regretfully.
"I don't much like the look of it either."
"We were told to stay here,"
Bowendal reminded him, steering the ponies into the barn while the others made for the door.
"I'll see to the ponies and keep an eye on the ingots. They'll be safer in the stables, I warrant. I'll sound my horn if I need you."
"Very well, I'll order you some food," Tungdil promised.
He pushed open the door and stepped into an impenetrable fog of smoke. Quite apart from the cloud of tobacco, it was evident that the chimney needed a thorough sweep. They made their way through the crowd of drinkers, sat down at a table by the fire, and stretched their soggy boots toward the flames.
"At least we won't be sleeping outside again," said Goimgar, softening. "I can't stand the rain."
The others nodded in silent agreement. None of them were accustomed to coming into contact with water unless they chose to, which was seldom enough.
"If only it were a bit more homely."
Tungdil was happy to forego all other comforts, provided that the roof didn't leak. The heat from the fire was beginning to dry his leather garments, and he closed his eyes with a contented sigh. Soon the conversation faded to an indistinct hum as he gave in to his tiredness and dozed. He woke when the publican arrived with a tray of food and beer, ordered by Bavrigor.
"Do you have a room for us? We're not fussy, so long as it's warm and dry."
The man nodded.
"Come this way."
The dwarves grabbed their packs, picked up their plates and tankards, and filed out behind him. They weren't sorry to be leaving the other drinkers, whose demeanor failed to inspire much trust. The chamber to which the publican led them was a garret room with a chimney breast at one end. The warmth exuding from the brickwork was enough to heat the whole room.
"Another beer for the gentleman?"
Bavrigor accepted with a nod. They hung their clothes to dry on a rope around the chimney. Then Boindil, wearing nothing but chainmail and breeches, left the chamber to take his turn in the stables. Tungdil waited until Boendal had joined them, then took off his boots, stood them next to the chimney breast, and climbed into a little bed.
"It's time for an afternoon nap," he told the others, pulling up the sheets. "I'll go into town and ask about the firstlings later. It will be good to know what to expect."
"It's been such a long time since anyone heard from them,"
said Bavrigor, shaking his tankard and gazing at the swirling beer.
"What if something's happened to them?"
"I expect they're just loners like you,"
Boendal teased him. He stripped to his chainmail and underwear and climbed into bed. The mason finished his beer, burped, and polished off the leftovers of Boendal's meal.
"I'd really like to meet them," he admitted. "I've been asking Vrakas to keep them safe."
He fell silent and stuffed his pipe with tobacco. Tungdil was staring at the beams overhead. The fine cracks in the paint reminded him of the way the elf's face had fractured.
"He knew my name."
"What's that, scholar?"
Boendal asked drowsily.
"The elf knew my name."
He reached for the headscarf that Frala had given to him. There was something soothing and reassuring about the cloth.
"They know more about me than I thought," he said uneasily.
"The most powerful of Tion's creatures are frightened of a dwarf,"
observed Bavrigor with a low chuckle. He lit his pipe, filling the chamber with the smell of tobacco spiced with a hint of brandy. It was surprisingly pleasant.
"That's the way we like it."
Gawimgar glanced over at Tungdil.
"I don't blame you for being concerned," he said with feeling. "I wouldn't want to be chased by a band of Alfar who know exactly who I am."
"Yes, but that's because you're a coward."
The insult left Bavrigor's lips before he had time to consider.
"If you haven't got anything useful to say, you may as well go to bed," Tungdil told him sharply. "They won't give each other a chance."
He saw Gawimgar look at him, then pick up his sword and shield and take up position on his bed, keeping a careful eye on the window and the door. Tungdil couldn't be sure whether the artisan was sitting watch for himself or the others. He was still considering the matter when he fell asleep. It was dark outside when Tungdil opened his eyes. His boots and clothes were drier than they had been in ages. No one else was awake, not even Gawimgar, who was snoring with his head lolling back against the wall. From the nose down, there was nothing to be seen of him except for his shield. It seemed a good time to get on with procuring the ponies and provisions, so Tungdil pulled on his warm clothes and dry boots, slipped into his mail tunic, and jammed his axe into his belt. At the last moment, he decided to leave the Sigurdaisy wood behind for safekeeping. Then he left the chamber and went down to the bar, stopping to tell the publican that he'd be back in a couple of hours. He stepped outside. The rain was still falling in torrents. A cold, malodorous wind gusted through the narrow streets. Nothing in his surroundings hinted at the opulence of the dwellings that graced the city's upper slopes.
"It's all very well for the rich folks in their mansions, high above the slums," he thought to himself. "Everyone down here is forced to look up at them, not knowing whether to hate them or admire them for their wealth."
He had several run-ins with particularly persistent beggars, and on one occasion he was chased by a pair of aging harlots who demanded to know if certain parts of his anatomy were as small and hairy as the rest. Tungdil ignored them because they offended his romantic sensibilities. His idea of love was gleaned from fiction and from Frala and her husband. He stroked his lucky scarf and tried to picture her in his mind. Knowing that he would never see her or her children again was even harder to deal with than the death of Lotionen. He would have done everything in his power to be a good guardian to Sunya and Ikana. The incessant rain, grey skies, and general squalor of Sovereignstone did nothing to improve his mood. He had to walk for what seemed like hours before he found a dealer who sold ponies, and even then he was instructed to call back the next morning. His next stop was a grocery store, where he bought provisions for the journey and succumbed to the temptation of buying a cake. He hadn't felt hungry until he saw it, but the mixture had risen perfectly to form a soft brown crust. The cinnamon streusel topping had melted in places, and delectable golden clumps nestled alongside rum-soaked raisins and sunken slices of fruit. Tungdil took a deep breath and bought the whole cake to share with the others, trusting to the baker to brighten his mood. In the dark, he set off through the streets, carrying his well-wrapped cake and other purchases. Mud and detritus clung to his boots, making them squelch unpleasantly. Not all the streets were properly cobbled, and parts of the waterlogged city were no better than mudslicks. Why would anyone want to live in this godforsaken place? It was inevitable that he would fall over, and fall over he did. He stepped on a soggy pile of horse dung, skidded on his right leg, and stumbled, reaching down with one hand to save his clothes from the worst of the muck. Somehow or other, he managed not to drop the cake. Underground vaults and strongholds are 1,000 times better than this. His thoughts were cut short by a sudden gust of wind. Something whizzed to the left of his head, grazing his ear. Whatever it was painful, and he yelped in surprise, reaching up to touch his neck. Warm blood trickled over his fingers. Turning sharply, he whipped out his axe.
"If you think you can part me from my money or my cake!"
The threat was left unfinished.
"They've found us."
Waiting at the other end of the alleyway was the Alf from Mifordania, who had tried to slit his throat. His cloak was fluttering in the stinking wind. He knocked a second arrow to his imposing bow and drew back his hand to release it. At precisely that moment, Tungdil was bowled over by something that charged toward him from the side. All he saw was a flash of violet light and a mask of gleaming silver, before he was hit with such force that he soared through the air and landed in the next passageway, skidding 4 paces and cutting a channel through the mud.
"What on?"
Head spinning, he rolled onto his back and held his axe at the ready, bracing himself for the Alf to find him and kill him. Nothing happened. Groaning, he stumbled to his feet. Every link in his mail shirt was oozing thick black mud. He looked dirtier than a pig that had been rolling in the muck. He peered around the corner warily. His cake was lying where he had dropped it, but the alley was deserted, and his footprints had been washed away by the driving rain. The only evidence of the disturbance was a black arrow and a strange yellow fluid that formed a garish trail through the puddles and the mud. Tungdil's earlobe was throbbing.
Why didn't the Alf kill me? Did someone stop him?
His body felt as if he'd collided with a wall. He tried to recall what had happened.
If I didn't know better, I'd think Jeroen had...
He gave up on the idea and bade a mournful farewell to the cake, then hurried through the streets, keeping an eye out for any Alfar who might be on his tail. On reaching the tavern, he raced upstairs and burst into their chamber, to find Boendal on the point of going out.
"Hello, scholar. Is everything all right?"
"Not exactly," said Tungdil, telling him quickly of the Alf's ambush and his miraculous escape.
"The sooner we leave Sovereignstone, the better."
Boendal frowned in concern.
"What possessed you to go wandering through the city on your own? An axe and a bit of learning aren't enough to protect you in a place like this."
He thought for a moment.
"If you ask me, it's not just the Sigurdaisy Wood they're after. Nadon wants us dead because we know his secret."
He woke Bavrogor and Goimgar to tell them what had happened, then went to join his brother in the stables. There would be no more sleep for any of them that night.
What if it was Jeroen after all?
Tungdil dismissed the idea. The armored giant and the Maegar were miles away in the outer lands. At first light, the three players were waiting at the gates as agreed. Narmora was wearing a leather cape and the red headscarf that she never seemed to be without, and Fergus had put on a long coat to keep himself as dry as possible, while the downpour showed no sign of letting up. The impresario seemed to have dressed in a hurry and was scanning the crowds nervously. The dwarves rolled up with their ponies and provisions.
"What's wrong?"
Boindil asked Rodario.
"Are the Alfar about?"
"It's not the Alfar he's worried about,"
replied Fergus. His tone implied that he had witnessed the scene before.
"After last night's performance, he put on a private showing for the innkeeper's daughter and his wife."
"Shush! Do you want me hounded out of town?"
hissed Rodario, glancing back and forth on the lookout for angry faces.
They told me they were separated.
There's always an excuse, Narmora said cynically. It's a pity their cuckolded husbands won't believe you. Bewindel whinnied with laughter.
The innkeeper's wife and his daughter!
34 cycles the one, and 16 the other, spring and summer in one bed, with me, the king of seasons, he bragged.
Narmora was unimpressed.
I'd say you're more of a wanton farmer who can't help ploughing foreign fields. For the most part, they accept your attentions because they're neglected by their own farmers, or because they pity a man with such a minuscule ploughshare.
Rodario stopped searching the crowd and focused on sparring with Narmora.
My dear lady, I understand your fascination with my mighty apparatus, but I'm most discerning about my choice of fields. Stony meadows give you bruises. They may appeal to some labourers, but not to me.
He flashed a smile at Fergus, then remembered what Boindil had asked him.
Alfar, did you say? He inquired with sudden seriousness. Right here in Sovereignstone? Why didn't you—
That's him!
The shout went up.
That's the scoundrel!
Rodario spotted the approaching pitchfork and fled. In no time, he was through the gates and wending his way nimbly among the queuing carts. A moment later, 4 men rushed past in hot pursuit. Bavragor and Boindil fell about laughing. Boendal shook his head silently, and Goimgar clung to his shield, ready to take shelter in case the Longans gave up on the adulterer and took their anger out on him. But the cuckolded husbands and their friends were intent on apprehending Rodario, who had successfully evaded them, leaving his pursuers searching furiously in the rain. The rest of the company left Sovereignstone in a more dignified fashion.
Alpha, said Narmora, returning to the initial question. Where?
Yesterday in the city. I was attacked by one. You didn't see any then?
Tungdil couldn't help feeling a mild aversion toward the actress, perhaps because of her elven looks.
She's an ordinary woman, he told himself. That's all.
She shook her head. They left us alone. At least we're forewarned. She laid her right hand on Crescent. About a mile from Sovereignstone, they were reunited with the philandering impresario, who was waiting under a fir tree and trying to shelter from the rain. Bavragor couldn't help laughing.
I hope they were worth it.
Indeed they were. A look of delectation came over Rodario's face. I suspect I wasn't the first to enjoy their combined attentions, but they certainly knew how to please. Realizing that the ponies were getting away from him, he sped up to a jog. That's all in the past now. Come, my loyal companions, let's make haste to the Firstling Kingdom, where unparalleled wonders await us. His stirring words were somewhat spoiled by the squelching beneath his feet, but he still cut a dash as an adventurer. Tungdil's memories of Sovereignstone weren't nearly as fond. He picked up the pace, unmoved by the city's fluttering pennants and colourful panorama of tiled roofs. Nothing could induce him to look back. Hurrying away from the pride of Weyen, he tried not to think of the Alf's murderous eyes.
I hope my mysterious rescuer killed him.
Chapter 3. Kingdom of Weyen, Girdlegard, Winter, 6,234th Solar Cycle. As soon as the opportunity arose, the travellers purchased a small cart for their baggage and a pair of horses, one for Rodario and the other for Narmora and Fergus. From then on, the journey westward proceeded considerably faster, not to mention more comfortably. Rodario, fearing the wrath of the cuckolded husbands, was especially keen to make progress, although it didn't deter him from using his charm and eloquence to make a string of conquests on the way. A fierce northerly brought with it the season's first snowstorm, the white flakes settling on the frozen ground to form a thick, icy layer. Winter seemed to descend on the land and its inhabitants faster and more vigorously than usual. Sleeping in the open was too dangerous, so the company camped out in places where they would be sheltered from the elements, under trees or rocky overhangs, or in derelict houses or ruined forts. The vast lakes that made up 3/4 of Weyern's surface were covered in ice. The sun and clouds played on the frozen water, creating glorious displays of shadow and light,
But the glittering spectacle could do nothing to win over the twins, who were too afraid of the icy depths to go fishing with Rodario and Fergus.
"Ice is just as dangerous as water,"
Boindil told them. He set about making a fire in the ruined temple where they were camping for the night.
"It looks so pretty that you forget to be careful, and then, whoa, you find yourself sinking to the bottom, never to be seen again."
"It's like marriage," observed Rodario. "Women tempt you into their arms, and before you know it, you're trapped for life. I'm more of the type for
bedding other people's wives. Not to mention being beaten by angry husbands and dying of the clap,"
Namora finished for him.
"Still jealous, I see," he riposted,
flashing her a dazzling smile as he hurried after Fergus, who was heading for a nearby stream. Boindil chuckled.
"My old billy goat was a bit like Rodario. He mounted anything that stayed still for 2 seconds.
"What became of him?"
"The old lecher jumped on a nanny goat and didn't notice that she was grazing near a cliff. He plummeted to his death."
He ran a razor over his cheeks to get rid of the stubble that was drawing attention away from his magnificent beard.
"In other words, Rodario will get his comeuppance by falling out of bed and breaking his neck," said Tungdil, grinning.
"Who said anything about a bed? It might be the window,"
Boindil pointed out. His brother hooted with laughter.
"What a sight!"
He scrambled along a fallen column that was propped up amid the ruins, and came to a halt at the top end, where he could see for miles around. He took a seat and lit his pipe. Boindil tossed him his share of the food.
"It will serve the old prattler right,"
chuckled Boindil, turning his attention hungrily to the cheese. Goimgar, wrapped in 2 blankets, with his shield laid across him like a third, had said nothing for some time. Eyes closed, he seemed to be asleep. The temple's moss-covered walls were alive with flickering shadows. Over the cycles, the frescoes had faded, and there were holes in the crumbling plaster. Not that the dwarves would have recognized the painted deities anyway. To their minds, there was only one god, and that was Vrakas. The rest weren't worth the time of day. The warmth from the blazing fire spread rapidly, casting a soft light throughout the temple and making the time-worn sculptures seem strangely alive. Tungdil found himself thinking of the performance in the Curiosum. He still couldn't decide how much of what he had seen had been acted by the players and how much had unfolded in his mind.
"It all seemed so real."
Muttering to himself, Bavrigor returned from his tour of the ruins.
"Not bad," was his verdict on the masonry, "but not worthy of us dwarves."
Tungdil offered him some bread and ham.
"Do you mind if I ask you something?"
Bavrigor accepted the food.
"Sounds ominous."
"It's been playing on my mind. You know the business with your sister?"
"Smeralda."
Bavrigor placed the sandwich on a stone to warm the bread and bring out the flavor of the meat. He took a long slug of brandy before continuing and said bitterly,
"I can't forgive him for what he did."
Tungdil didn't press him. He had a feeling that Bavrigor was ready to open up to him, and after a while the mason cleared his throat.
"She was a slip of a thing, a lass of 40 cycles, but as soon as he clapped eyes on her, he wanted her for himself. She was as much of a warrior as he was, and she trained like a demon because she wanted to be able to fight by his side."
He clenched his fists as the memories flooded back.
"The rest of us were worried about his fiery spirit, and we begged her to stay away. Smeralda wouldn't listen, and everything went on as before. The two of them were fighting a band of orcs when he..."
He broke off, covering his good eye with one hand and raising his pouch to his mouth with the other.
"He killed her, Tungdil. He was so far gone in bloodlust that he took her for an orc."
Tungdil pushed back the lump in his throat and blinked.
"An orc. Afterward, they said it was a tragedy and a terrible accident, and he swears he can't remember a thing. But I couldn't care less. My sister died because of him. I don't know if you could forgive him, but I don't intend to."
Tungdil knew there was nothing he could say. The story was unspeakably sad. He laid a hand on Bavrigor's arm.
"I'm sorry I put you through it again.
he said simply. Listening to the mason had brought back the pain of losing Lotionen and Frala, who had been like a sister to him.
I can almost understand how he feels.
So now you know,
sighed Bavrogor, taking a deep breath and flushing away the memories with a long draught of brandy. His ham sandwich lay untouched and forgotten by the fire. Tungdil looked up and glanced at Boindil, who was guarding the camp from his lookout on the fallen pillar and puffing on his pipe. Blue smoke rings wafted into the darkness, rising through the falling flakes, and Tungdil thought for a moment that he could hear the hiss of hot tobacco on snow.
The fieriness of his inner furnace is a curse, Boendal said sadly. He still can't remember what happened on the bridge. All he knows is that Smeralda was lying dead at his feet, and he thought the orcs had killed her. When Bavrogor and the others told him that she'd died by his axes.
Weren't you with him?
I wish I had been. I keep telling myself that if I hadn't been injured, I might have stopped him before it was too late.
He scratched at a rusty patch on his chainmail and oiled the corroded links.
He calls out to her in his sleep sometimes. Trust me, scholar, he suffers just as much as Bavrogor, but he'd never admit it.
Boendal filled his pipe, and they took turns smoking, each pursuing his thoughts. Tungdil looked out of the crumbling window and saw that the snow was falling faster than before. A pair of snowmen appeared in the doorway. Fergus and Rodario were back from fishing. The prop master had caught two fully grown carp, but the impresario was clutching a single, insubstantial tench.
A god among ploughmen, but a terrible fisherman, commented Bavrogor,
hoping that a bit of banter would dispel his gloomy thoughts. Rodario didn't rise to the taunt.
What's the use of being a god when the mortals forsake you?
He pointed to the crumbling, damp-ridden frescoes.
Deities need lesser beings to adore them, or they fade and die. They lose their purpose. There's no reason for them to exist.
Vrakis doesn't need a purpose, Boendal told him firmly. He created himself because it suited him, not because of anyone else.
I'm familiar with the creation myths, thank you, and I certainly don't need any sermons from you.
The impresario turned his attention to filleting his fish.
We used to perform them on stage, very successfully, I might tell you. It's true what they say, old stories are always the best, although in the present circumstances our play about Nodon seems to strike a chord.
That was Tungdil's cue, to ask him about the theatrical effects he had witnessed in the Curiosum. Ever since the performance, he had been longing to find out how they made the illusions seem so real.
You're interested in how we did it?
Rodario pointed his scaly knife at Fergus.
Ask the expert.
While the impresario continued to hack away at the unfortunate tench, Fergus finished gutting the first carp and started on the second.
I know a fair bit about alchemy. That's how we make the smoke, for example. Thick smoke, wispy smoke, red smoke, black smoke, whatever we need. The science of the elements is fascinating.
Alchemy was one of the subjects taught by Lotionen at the school, and Tungdil was familiar with some of the chemicals, having fetched and carried them often enough.
But how did you extinguish all the lamps at once?
Magic,
Rodario whispered, trying to look enigmatic.
You thought Nodon was the only magus left in Gertlegard, didn't you?
He leaned over to Tungdil, fiddled with his ear, and pulled out a gold coin.
What do you say to that?
Thank you, said Tungdil, snatching up the coin. He tested it with his teeth and knew at once that he'd been had.
Gold-plated lead, he reported.
And not even good quality gold. He tossed back the coin.
Your magic's not up to much.
He's a conjurer, not a magus,
laughed Boendal, pointing at the impresario with the stem of his pipe. Rodario wagged a finger at him.
But the audience falls for it, and that's what counts. Why, even the ugly little Bognilim were tricked by my art, and that, my friends, is what's known as success.
So it's all a case of conjuring illusion and alchemy, said Tungdil, summing up.
Fergus nodded.
And makeup,
he added, glancing at his slender mistress.
Makeup convinces the eye of what it otherwise only suspects. It turns Narmora into an alf, and sends the youngsters screaming to their parents.
He laughed.
That's when we know we're doing something right. Just be thankful it was Tungdel and not our lunatic axeman who visited your theater,
Bavrigor said darkly.
He would have stormed the stage.
Poor Narmora,
Boendal murmured unthinkingly.
Even without makeup, she looks remarkably like an elf. Nature can be cruel sometimes.
The comment prompted smiles from Fergus and Rodario, but Narmora shot the startled secondling a murderous look. Tungdel and Bavrigor fell about laughing, thereby waking Goimgar, who peered nervously over his shield.
Oh, said Boendal, embarrassed. That came out all wrong. I didn't mean it that way,
he apologized. Are you sure I look like an elf, not an alf? Narmora said threateningly. Her eyes, so dark they were almost black, glowered at him angrily. I hope none of you get a nasty shock tonight. She stood up, straightened her headscarf, and left the ruined temple. Her silhouette melted into the darkness.
Ye gods, she's a natural, Rodario gushed. Doesn't she play the role to perfection? Of course, I've no intention of telling her. She'd only demand a raise.
He looked excitedly at the others for confirmation, and the dwarves concurred with mute nods. Boendal was genuinely perturbed about what might befall him when he fell asleep that night. The men finished filleting their catch, and soon there was a smell of roasted fish. They all tucked in hungrily.
There's one thing I don't understand, Tungdel said to Fergus. How did you make the set? Everything, the woods, the palace, it looked so real.
Can you keep a secret?
Of course.
Do I have your word?
Absolutely.
Swear by the blade of your axe.
Tungdel swore himself to absolute secrecy.
Magic,
announced Fergus with a mischievous grin. He smoothed his moustache.
Sighed
Tungdel, kicking himself for falling for the routine. Boendal sat up with a jolt and stifled a scream. For all the shock of being woken, he was glad to have escaped the visions that had plagued his sleep. His relief was short-lived. On reaching for his crow's beak, he was alarmed to discover that the weapon was gone. Slender fingers encircled his wrist. He rolled over to find himself staring into the cruel, lean face of an elf. Clad in full armor, she was crouched beside him, studying him with cold, dark eyes.
I'm still dreaming, he told himself frantically. It can't be.
Let that be a lesson to you, he heard her hiss menacingly, just as his eyelids grew impossibly heavy and he drifted off to sleep.
When he woke for the second time, he leapt up, spluttering and gasping, and whirled round to face the threat. This time, his crow's beak was in its proper place, and he snatched it up hastily. The players were asleep, Narmora in Fergus's arms, and Rodario, head resting in a pile of discarded fish skin, nestled beside the dying fire. Boendal studied them carefully. It didn't look as though they were playing a joke on him. Heart still pounding, he recovered some of his composure and vowed never to offend the actress again. It occurred to him that Goimgar was supposed to be keeping watch for them, but the lookout post was empty and the sentry had vanished. The horses and ponies were all safely tethered, but a trail of footprints led away from the door.
Surely he's not daft enough to run away in a snowstorm.
Boendal took a few steps outside and was almost knocked over by a flurry of snowflakes that seemed intent on laying him out. Suddenly he spotted a figure crumpled in the snow.
Goimgar!
Boendal rushed over, but the artisan didn't respond. Blood was trickling from a narrow gash in his head. Boendal carried him into the ruined temple, laid him next to the fire, and threw on a couple of extra logs.
I...
Goimgar's teeth were chattering furiously.
I slipped.
Boendal covered him with two blankets.
He can't even pee without getting himself in a fix.
Tactfully, he refrained from comment. Goimgar had humiliated himself sufficiently already. Why Tungdel had picked the troublesome artisan was beyond him, especially with four perfectly acceptable diamond cutters to choose from.
Thrakus is bound to have his reasons, he thought philosophically,
as the bundle of misery slowly began to thaw. His beard, hair, and eyebrows were streaming with icy water. Boendal leaned over to talk to him.
Were you trying to get yourself killed out there?
No,
came the eventual reply.
Be more careful in the future. We need you for our mission.
You mean the imposter needs me to help him stick with the throne?
The shivering artisan muttered darkly. Boendal didn't bother to reply. The Fourthling still hadn't grasped that more was at stake than the succession, despite Tungdil's well-meaning attempts to set him straight.
How can anyone be so obtuse? Everything depends on the success of our mission, but he's too stubborn to see it.
Goimgar stopped shivering and stared straight past him toward the rear of the temple, where the marble gods were grouped. He gulped.
How many?
He whispered.
I beg your pardon?
How many statues were here when we arrived?
Boendal thought for a moment.
7. 4 big ones and 3 small ones.
Goimgar closed his eyes.
There are 8 of them,
he hissed.
5 big ones. What are we going to do?
Which one wasn't there before?
Boendal's fingers were already wrapped around the haft of his crow's beak. He tensed his muscles.
The 3rd from the right.
Fine. I'll go in for the attack and shout to wake the others. Meanwhile, you grab your shield and back me up until Boendal takes over.
Me? Who else am I supposed to ask?
Before Goimgar could protest, the crow's beak swung up in a half circle, its long tip speeding toward the area just above the hips, where there were no bones to slow its path. The wound would be deep and deadly. Like a miniature pennant, Boendal's plat traced the weapon's movement in the air.
For Vrakas!
He bellowed. The statue shattered under the force of the blow, the crow's beak smashing through the crumbling stone and dashing it to pieces. The damage to the deity, carved lovingly by humans, was absolute and irrevocable.
Sorry,
Goimgar said contritely.
I meant 3rd from my right.
By then, it was too late. The hitherto inanimate statue suddenly came to life. Its eyes glowed lilac beneath its visor.
Of all the dumb mistakes!
Boendal swore under his breath and made to strike again. His titanic adversary had other ideas. Moving with a speed that belied its size, the statue seized the dwarf's forearms in its enormous hands and lifted him clean into the air. Boendal found himself dangling 2 paces above the ground. His weapon clattered to the cracked marble floor. His brother was on his feet already.
Let go of him!
Whipping out his axes, he was about to launch himself on his colossal opponent when he was blinded by a flash of light. The glare was so bright that he had to look away.
That's enough, Boindil!
Commanded a distinctive female voice. The glare softened to a weak glow, allowing them all to see. The speaker emerged from behind the remaining statues and joined the giant's side. Her crimson cloak was streaked with melting snow, and she was holding a glowing sphere.
You can put Boendal down now, Jerun. I think they know who we are.
Andakai!
Cried Tungdil in astonishment, lowering his axe.
You're back!
She threw back her hood to show them her face.
Andokai? Andokai the Maegor of Brandokai? Andokai the Tempestuous?
Inquired Rodario. He didn't seem to notice that his cheeks were covered in fish scales and that he was scarcely looking his best.
Isn't she supposed to be dead?
He stared at her brazenly.
Confound it, you're right!
He turned to Fergus and Narmora.
Andokai's alive! We'll have to rewrite the play.
What play? Slipping the globe inside her cloak, the Maegor strode to the fire and warmed her hands. Jerun lowered Boendal to the floor.
What's he talking about? Who is he, anyway?
An impresario, Tungdil said apologetically. It took all his self-control not to bombard her with questions.
I see. I've been immortalized in a play already, have I? I hope the actress is suitably...
Rodario was about to launch into a flattering explanation when Boendal rounded on the Maegor.
What the blazes was your giant up to? How was I supposed to know he was spying on us? I could have killed him!
He wasn't spying. He was guarding your camp.
And no, there was never any danger of you killing him, she informed him in a condescending tone. She took off her cloak to allow the warmth to penetrate her other clothes. Underneath, she was wearing full armor, thick winter garments, and a sword. She was broad-shouldered by nature, and the layers only added to her bulk. He was here at my request to protect you from the Alpha. They've been following you since Mifredania.
I knew they were hunting us,
wailed Goimgar. Boindil laughed.
I'd rather die in a fight with the Alpha than be saved by a beast. Leave the pointy ears to me.
He stroked the short hafts of his axes. I doubt you would have spotted them in time. They managed to follow you this far without you seeing them, the Maegar said gravely. Jeroen killed a couple of them 3 miles from here, but two escaped. I sent Jeroen ahead in case they tired of tracking you and decided to attack.
So it was him who rescued me in Sovereignstone. I thought as much, said Tungdil.
Andokine nodded. I'm afraid your attacker got away.
I wouldn't have let the pointy-eared murderer escape with his life, growled Boindil. My enemies never get the better of me, even if I have to chase them down.
I'm assuming you've never been shot at by an elf archer. She gave the dwarf a pitying look. And anyway, warriors who run after their enemies should be careful about being trapped.
My enemies never trap me,
Boindil said mulishly. He took up his old position atop the fallen pillar. The extra height brought him level with the giant. He peered through the visor, curious to see what lay among the shadows, but his eyes, despite being accustomed to darkness, failed to penetrate the gloom. It was as if Jeroen's helmet contained nothing but bottomless space. The others sat down in a circle around the fire. By this time the players were wide awake. While Namora returned her fantastical weapons to her belt, Rodario whipped out his notepad and quill, only to discover that the ink was frozen solid. Jeroen had already retreated to the rear of the temple, where he transformed himself into a statue and waited in the gloom. Tungdil waited for everyone to settle.
What changed your mind, Maegar? He asked at last. How did you find us?
Your new companions can be trusted, I assume.
They helped us get here. You can trust them.
Boindil grunted disapprovingly from his perch.
You can trust us with your lives, Rodario declared expansively, seizing the opportunity to introduce the troop in characteristically florid style. We know all about Keenfire, of course. In fact, he said, waving his arms extravagantly, we rescued these future heroes, these champions of legends as yet unwritten, from a fate most foul by plucking them from the claws and swords of a pack of vicious Bognilim. We're completely reliable, most estimable Maegar.
Under normal circumstances, his smile had the power to melt the thickest ice and soften the hardest stone, but this time it failed. Andokai was unmoved.
You made me come back, she said accusingly, glaring at Tungdil. It's your fault for hounding me about my duty. Everything you said kept running through my head until I couldn't take it any longer. My conscience wouldn't let me abandon Gerdlegard, and so I returned. Besides, there are 1,000 reasons why Nodon deserves to die.
Her face seemed less severe in the flickering light of the fire. Her features somehow softer, more feminine. Rodario couldn't take his eyes off her, and was hanging on her every word. He seemed to regard her forbidding charm and stern manner as a challenge to his seductive powers. So I went back to Ogre's death and took another look at the passage that I hadn't been able to make sense of. You remember, don't you? The only remaining uncertainty in the plan. Gazing into the flames, she motioned with her hand, marshalling the sparks into the script of the common tongue. One by one, the words flared up and faded in an instant. Rodario read them aloud.
Keenfire must be forged by the undergroundlings, then wielded by the undergroundlings' foe.
He snatched up a piece of charred wood.
I need to write it down before I forget. What use is a quill without ink? I could kick myself for letting it freeze.
You write, and I'll kick, Bavrigor said magnanimously.
The gods save me from your hulking boots, exclaimed Rodario, shooing him away. Wait and see. We'll have the best play ever performed in Gerdlegard.
His hand moved busily across the page.
They'll be fighting to get through the door.
He was about to launch into another effusive speech, but Fergus jabbed him in the ribs.
The undergroundling's foe, murmured Tungdil, unable to mask his disappointment.
What could it mean?
Boendal couldn't make sense of it either.
We've got no shortage of foes. Ogres, for example.
He cast a sideways glance at Jeroen.
Not to mention orcs, Bognilim, and all the other beasts created by Teon to plague the kingdoms of men, elves, and dwarves. Come on, scholar. Surely you can think of something. A bit of book learning might be exactly what we need.
Bavrigor took a swig of his brandy.
We could have a bit of fun with this. Why don't we catch an orc and torture him until he agrees to clobber Nadon? Or maybe we could talk an ogre into taking a swipe at him with our axe.
I guess that's the end of the expedition, then, said Goimgar, readily accepting defeat.
He suddenly paled.
Who's going to tell the others? King Gandagar doesn't know.
Tungdil expelled his breath in a long sigh.
Are you absolutely sure of the meaning? He asked slowly.
The Maegar nodded. I'm afraid so. I read it over and over again.
Do you have any suggestions?
He glanced at Jeroen. She smiled. Jeroen isn't your foe, if that's what you're thinking. He can't do it. Tungdil scratched his beard, which had grown to something approaching its former length.
Then we're facing a considerable obstacle.
He looked into the faces of his companions. I don't know what to suggest. He lay down and pulled up his blanket.
Maybe Vrakas will send me some inspiration in the night. Get some rest. We're bound to need our strength for whatever lies ahead.
They settled down by the fire while Jeroen kept watch.
I have to think of something. I'm in charge, thought Tungdil, tossing and turning restlessly. If I don't come up with a solution to the riddle, Gerdlegard will be doomed.
It wasn't the sort of thought that would lull anyone to sleep. Tungdil still hadn't received divine inspiration by the time they broke camp at first light. They decided to carry on regardless. With a bit of luck, one of them would think of something on the way, and if not, there was always a chance that the firstlings would be able to help.
We'll get there in the end, Tungdil told himself firmly, slipping his freshly oiled and rust-free mail shirt over his leather jerkin.
Andokai rode with Rodario. The impresario had imagined himself sitting behind her on the saddle, with his arms wrapped chivalrously around her waist, but she insisted on riding bareback to give them both more space. Not only that, she forced him to take his place in front of her while she held the reins, much to Fergus's amusement. More snow had fallen overnight, adding to the existing coating by the length of a forearm or so. The horses had to plough a path for the short-legged ponies to follow, and so they proceeded in single file, with Jeroen trudging behind them. From a distance, it looked as if one of the marble deities had left the tedium of the temple and joined the procession instead. The going was tough for the unusual band of travellers. Winter slowed their progress considerably, and Tungdil realized the advantage of travelling underground. They needed to get to the Grey Range as fast as possible, and by foot, or even on horseback, the journey would take too long. In a week, they advanced 200 miles, a distance that could be covered in one or two orbits on the underground rail. That afternoon, while they rested their horses, he pestered Andokai to tell him how she had tracked the company down.
It was no great challenge, she said dryly. I left the outer lands, went back to Ogre's death, and persuaded the secondlings to show me the tunnels. We came up near Mifordania, Jeroen found your tracks, and the rest was easy. People tend to notice a group of travelling dwarves. It wouldn't have been hard for the Alfar to find you either.
Tungdil glanced at Namora, who was helping Fergus shovel snow into a pan and melt it over the fire. The Maegar's gaze settled on Rodario.
These actors, how did you meet them?
Tungdil recounted the story.
Ah-ha! Laughed the Maegar on hearing how Namora had got them out of Mifordania by picking the locks. So she's a woman of many talents. Have you seen their play?
I certainly have. The production was a sellout.
It's called The Truth About Nudin the Knowledge Lusty and the Grisly Circumstances Leading to His Reincarnation as Nudon the Doublefold and Resulting in Gerdlegard's Demise.
A snappy title, she observed.
For the first time, Tungdil saw the corners of her mouth turn upward, and it occurred to him that smiling suited her better than her usual stern expression. Rodario chose precisely that moment to look over his shoulder, and naturally assumed that the friendly smile was meant for him. He beamed back delightedly.
And that's the star of the show, the fabulous Rodario. According to the others, he keeps a mistress in every town.
I don't doubt it. Who plays me?
I'm afraid I left early, estimable Mega. I had to chase a thief.
He beckoned to Rodario.
You'll have to ask him.
The impresario bounded over to be cross-examined by the Mega.
My players are the most accomplished in all Gerdlegard. Your role was played by the talented Narmora, who alone could emulate your prowess with a sword.
At her request, he embarked on an explanation of the plot, but she cut him short when he was halfway through.
The rise of the perished land, Nodon's visitation, his compact with evil. What gave you the idea?
I listened to the rumors, combined them with some ancient legends, and added a dash of inspiration of my own.
He looked at her brightly.
Does it meet with your approval?
It's incredibly accurate, at least as far as Nudin's transformation is concerned.
Really?
Rodario seemed genuinely surprised.
But then, truth is at the heart of all great art, wouldn't you say?
Thank you, Rodario. You can go now, Andukai told him briskly. And don't forget to rewrite my part in your play. I'm not dead yet.
My dear Mega, you're positively blooming, he said, turning on the charm and gazing seductively into her clear blue eyes. No man could...
I'm busy, she informed him, turning back to Tungdil. Rodario's magnificent smile was wiped off his face. His pointed beard seemed to droop in dismay.
I respect your wishes, he said in a dignified tone.
The Mega has sent the peacock packing, chuckled Bavrigor, who had followed the little scene. Poor Rodario, his magnificent feathers are trailing on the ground. I'd advise him to back off now, while he's still in possession of his plumage.
He rummaged around for his drinking pouch and started humming a ballad under his breath.
No chance, said Fergus.
He lay back in the snow.
When Rodario's got his eye on a woman, he never gives up. Her sternness will only encourage him.